Dr. Devon Singh is an associate professor of religion at Dartmouth College, founder of a leadership and executive coaching business called Leadership Kinetics, and an author of some pretty controversial books about the intersection between religion and commerce. Our conversation is a joyfully intense back and forth that sometimes felt more like a good tennis match and less like a podcast. We peeled back the layers to reveal how he quieted the voices of self-doubt and overcame violent trauma to answer some of the greatest existential questions that we've all likely faced. Who am I? What is my purpose on the planet? And how do I heal the brokenness within me?
Hello, and welcome to a new season of At the Podium with me, Patrick Huey. At the Podium is a multimedia platform that brings together people from a diverse background of lives, careers, and experiences who all share one thing in common. They have stepped fully into the transformative power of finding and raising their voices to make an impact on our world today. At the Podium holds a space for everyone to share their stories, to be heard, and to bring us inspiration. Today, I'm thrilled to share the podium with Dr. Devon Singh. Devon is the founder and president of Leadership Kinetics, LLC, a coaching and leadership development firm that helps high achievers take their leadership impact and effectiveness to the next level. His clients include dynamic corporate executives, driven founders, and established leaders whose definition of success entails a life of meaning, impact, and integrity. Devon is also a tenured associate professor of religion at Dartmouth College, where he teaches courses in religion, philosophy, ethics, organizational dynamics, and the connections among religion, economics, and politics. He serves as a guest lecturer at Tuck School of Business and has held positions at Harvard, Yale, and Princeton. Devon received his PhD from Yale, his MA from the University of Chicago, and Masters of Divinity from Trinity Divinity School, and a BA from Pomona College. He is the author of Divine Currency, The Theological Power of Money in the West, which examines the influential connections among money, religions, and politics in Western society. He is also the author of Economy and Modern Christian Thought, which provides an introduction to the study of religion and economics. Devon identifies as Asian American and multiracial. Being raised in diplomatic and international development contexts and having visited, lived, or studied in more than 35 countries, Devon brings a global and culturally aware perspective to his coaching and his training. Okay, Devon, welcome to At the Podium.
Patrick, it's great to be here. I really appreciate the work that you're doing here at the Podium.
It's such an honor to have you on. I'm very impressed by the work that you're doing. I think you're filling a needed and interesting space between religion, politics, economics, and in many ways, I would say ethics. Would you not agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think ethics are a key part of what I'm interested in and trying to bring to the conversation.
I was reading in your writings, and we'll get into your work, but I was looking at your biography and sort of understanding who you were as a person. And you've said in your writings that ever since you were at a very young age, you were obsessed with personal growth and development. And you say that your home life required that you look elsewhere for how to lead and manage yourself, your emotions, and your life direction. If you can, I would love to know what was happening in your home life that led you to look outside of the home for those necessary skills.
Sure. Well, I would say I came from a context, home life that lacked stability and lacked, for lack of a better term, healthy models for what it looks like to manage conflict, to manage anger and emotions. My parents separated and got divorced when I was very young, and that was a very tumultuous relationship between the two of them in terms of certainly psychological and verbal abuse, as well as occasionally physical violence that I witnessed and was exposed to. And then I also moved around a lot growing up because of my mother's work. My mom worked for the Foreign Service, and I moved almost on average every year to a new city, new school. I was always the new kid in school, often arriving a few months after school had already started, when everyone had already made their friendships, etc. So multiplying the effect of feeling alienated, feeling shy, feeling closed off. So that was traumatic, moving around a lot. It was traumatic. My mother was dealing with her own traumas, her own as an abuse survivor herself, her own challenges she was working through. And so I really felt like I needed to find models of what it looked like to live my life in a way that felt more aligned with flourishing. So part of it, this quest to explore personal growth and development, I think came from a real sense of my own inadequacies, my own brokenness, if you will. But also something that I'm thankful for and can't really take credit for is just some drive for resilience and growth that, you know, I had a growth mindset. And so it really prompted me to look for mentors as well as to read and to explore this literature of personal growth and development. I mean, I joke that I was this teenager who was reading personal growth books, and I don't know how many teens do that. So it was kind of a weirdo, you know, and I mean that in the best sense, right? So I've always been voraciously interested and hungry to learn more about what it means to develop an attitude of optimism and resilience and growth, what it means to deal with confrontation and conflict in ways that are healthy and productive as opposed to violent and destructive, how to overcome self-doubt, limiting beliefs, senses of, you know, holding oneself back or stifling one's own voice in the world. Those kinds of questions are things that really preoccupied me and then have in turn led me to, you know, informally and then formally coach and share that with others as people have come across my path who have been on similar journeys and similar quests.
What do you think led you to that option, the option of self-growth, discovery, reading, and intellectual curiosity, given the sort of violent nature that you grew up in? What drew you there? Because I think for many people, growing up in those circumstances, they're drawn to other ways to deal with that may not be as productive and fruitful as what you've described your journey to be.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a hard question to answer because these are very sort of early moments in my life. And some of it, I think, again, came from just my natural personality as one who was attracted to ideas of hope and perseverance as opposed to despair, although I certainly struggled and continue to struggle with moments of depression, melancholy, and despair. Those things are very real still. But I think this sense and this hunger that there's more out there, a curiosity about the world, about people, and I wouldn't have used this term then, but something like an aesthetic sense, a sense of beauty, a sense that there's beauty to encounter in the world, there's beauty to experience, and wanting to experience that, wanting to seek that out. And some of that I also credit for my upbringing. My mom, despite many of her flaws and shortcomings, did try to expose me to art, to creativity, to a sense of other worlds that are possible or other worlds that I might create to forge sort of a better reality for myself.
I was reading some of your articles, which are fabulous, by the way. You talk about mourning being a part of a healthy decision-making process. I don't think we talk about that when we talk about making decisions right now. We talk about move forward, leave it behind, go forward, don't look back. But there really is a sense of when you make a decision, there's always something that's being left behind. Can you go deeper into that point of view on mourning and healthy decision-making?
Particularly in Western culture and in the US in particular, we shy away from grief and mourning and try to focus on positivity. And I think obviously there's a right way to focus on positivity, and there's kind of a toxic positivity that is in denial of the hard things about life, right? And some of that, I think, comes up a lot in the coaching and personal development world as well, where the focus on the positive, there's too much of an emphasis on that where it misses the real need to deal with pain, sadness, loss, trauma. And this might also relate to going back to your question about my own upbringing. I think I learned very early that it was important to sort of face and come to grips with hard moments and losses and to grieve those things in order to move on. So that spurred me to think about this issue of decision-making. Often I feel like we get stuck and we're unable to move forward because we haven't processed this grief. And it may be minuscule, it may be insignificant, or it may be significant. But the grief, as you say, that comes with making decisions where we choose between different options, and there's always something that's left behind in some way. And we talk a lot about win-win decision-making, win-win collaboration, where we want to say that, oh, maybe there's nothing that's lost or given up. But I think in reality, there's always something that is given up in order to choose a certain path. And that's okay. That's part of what life's about, right? But if we feel ourselves being stuck or frozen, unable to make those decisions, or if we feel ourselves having made a decision and always looking back, unable to really progress, that may be a sign that we really haven't come to grips with, felt, sat with, processed, whatever small or large level of grief we have. You know, there's almost a ritual to this. And I know we'll talk a little bit later about religion, but religion is one of those structures that I think humans have evolved to think about how to process things like grief and trauma. We've constructed mourning rituals. Think about funerals, for instance. And I'm often struck watching funerals, particularly in other non-Western contexts where there's very, very open displays of grief, mourning, sadness, people throwing themselves on the casket, people wailing. And often this is shown in Western media as something that's strange, as different, as other. And I can imagine many American viewers and Western viewers thinking this is too much emotion being shown. But I think there's a wisdom there. There's a wisdom there in really pouring out and opening oneself up to let that grief out as a right way to process this. And so that's an example of a kind of ritual that one might use. But I think we can create our own kinds of rituals and just habits to take time to step back, to process things that are difficult in order to move through them and move toward positive growth.
You talk about this idea of grief and melancholy. You did some really interesting work around the life of Gen Xers, which I think were probably both Gen Xers. And I thought what was really interesting about the article that you wrote was that you really kind of captured the plight and the melancholy, the mourning sense of kind of those of us who fall into this category of Gen Xers. Because it feels like, you know, the millennials are out affirming their lives and tilting at windmills, and our parents are out changing the world. And we were kind of left to microwave our after-school snacks and basically keep the lights on for the world of the last three decades. And so I think there is a sense of loss. And I think a lot of us in our generation bought into ideas, bought into belief systems, ideas about who we were supposed to be in the world that may not have necessarily aligned with our inner truth, if I can use that word. And now there is a sense of loss that can sort of accompany the bigger choices that we make as we get into our late 40s, early 50s. And so I wonder if that idea of melancholy and mourning is born out of the experience of just where we fell into the sort of world of generations on the planet.
I think it's totally connected. I mean, that's one of the key marks, right? I mean, we're the latchkey generation, the generation that was in some sense neglected and overlooked, that raised itself. I wrote this article in part because I kept seeing so many other articles, blogs, posts that talk about boomers and millennials. And it's just that there's this consistent overlooking and neglect even today about Generation X, even in the literature out there about leadership, about work, about all these different themes. So it struck me that oversight continues. And yes, we're the generation that's marked by things like, you know, alternative and grunge music that was very much in tune with the hypocrisy and brokenness of life. A certain kind of protest hip hop and protest rap that came out of our generation as well, that was very much sort of facing hypocrisy, exploitation, and oppression. And there are so many things that Generation X brings in terms of this ability to be independent and work independently, but also to collaborate. I mean, we're the generation. Think of all these sort of Brat Pack type movies that came out of our generation, of these kids sort of going on adventures together, the Goonies, the Breakfast Club, whatever it may be, people bonding together, usually no parents around, no oversight, or if there is, it's kind of a problematic oversight. So we're the generation that understands sort of horizontal leadership, collaborative leadership, all of that as well. And so yeah, there's a lot that we bring, and we are moving into these leadership positions. I mean, if you think about in society right now and in this age range, I mean, Gen Xers are the ones that are moving into various leadership roles. And so there needs to be more conversation in public about what it means to lead as a Gen Xer and what unique and specific gifts and talents that we bring because of these experiences, some of which were hard and that have shaped us, I think, in ways that we bring a really unique perspective.
You talk about that we straddled this world where we were obviously born and alive before the internet and technology and Facebook and Instagram. And yet we're fully ensconced in that. And we sort of have this adaptability to be able to move between these two worlds really fluently with a lot of facility, which is an interesting superpower, I guess you could say.
I was watching a show the other night where somebody time traveled back to the 80s and, you know, they didn't have their cell phone, but they, you know, they found a phone booth. And it was kind of, the joke was that, you know, we're the sort of the last generation that can do that. Like millennials and others, if they time traveled back to a phone booth, they wouldn't know what to do with it, right? Whereas we sort of still understand that strange, you know, straddling that divide. We're these cuspers. And I think there are gifts that we bring to be able to, as you said, see that and see the differences between those perspectives, to not be fully immersed in that, to imagine a world where we didn't have Google at our hands to answer every sort of question, and the kinds of critical thinking skills that we've developed because of that. So it's an important perspective that we continue to offer in terms of thinking about infrastructure, leadership, how you arrange organizations, all these kinds of things that we can speak to in unique ways.
I want to switch gears a little bit. You've done a lot of work in writing. You are an associate professor within the field of religion at Dartmouth College. And I wanted to just dive into you around some of the concepts that you pioneered and talked about in your work. And in your work, you really draw a direct line between the language we use to talk about religion with the language we use to talk about economy and currency. And when I first read that, it was like a light bulb going off, because again, I think you were looking at it from a very different perspective, and you really create this idea of the religification of commerce. Am I right in understanding this relationship as you see it, as you dive into this connection between money and Christian theology?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, most folks, even if they're not too acquainted with religion or Christianity in particular, have a sense that religions often have something to say about money and economics, right? Like, people have the sense that, oh, there were monks, there were people who said wealth is perhaps dangerous, or you should share your wealth with the poor. This is a generally familiar idea. But what I wanted to uncover was the ways that religious language and thought actually used ideas of money and economics to structure itself and express itself. And so what my work does is uncover, in Christianity in particular, how early Christian thinkers who sort of defined Christianity for future generations borrowed ideas of money, exchange, economics from the world around them, in this case, from the early Roman economy, to explain things like salvation, explain things like who God is, what God does. And so there are these structuring concepts, metaphors, ideas that are really economic and monetary. And so it does lead to this religification of commerce, or the commercialization of religion. I mean, it goes both ways. And so part of what I was interested in uncovering is part of the power and influence that money and economics seems to have today, partly the result of this long connection between language about religion and God and salvation and all these things that carried so much weight for generations within our society. And perhaps, you know, if maybe we've moved beyond this into more of a secular society, I think that's still debatable. But even if religion is not as influential, maybe it still has influence through economics, the ways that economics has an almost religious aura, an almost sacred power to it because of this longstanding connection.
Is that theory, that this theory that you're proposing, in a way totally antithetical to what the Bible is about and what religion in the purest form, if we're going to think about it, is about? This idea of currency and transaction, which seems to be not what the Bible in many ways or religious texts talk about. They actually say that transactional nature between people is totally not where we are in terms of a spiritual life, or where we should be in terms of a spiritual life. So are you kind of turning the whole thing on its head a little bit? Are you making us rethink what religion is supposed to be?
That's what I'm hoping to do. And part of this, and to be clear, what I see myself doing is being descriptive and retrieving ideas that are there. Like, I don't see this as, you know, I'm building a new sort of way to understand religion. What I'm trying to do is show these ideas that have always been there that many people have missed, or that religion has sort of ignored. So while it is absolutely true, as you say, that a lot of aspects of religion seem to be very antagonistic or suspicious of things like wealth, money, and this transactional interaction, at the same time, some of these same thinkers are using transactional, economic, and monetary language to describe religion. So it's this push-pull, this kind of both-and that's happening at the same time. And I think that's actually part of why, again, we in the West, who are sort of inheritors of this, have this really ambivalent relationship with money and economy. I don't feel like it's a very settled thing. I think people have this sense of unease where should I want money? Is it okay to want money or not? Is it dangerous to pursue it too much? Is money going to cause happiness or unhappiness? There are all these really live, important issues that we should debate and discuss. And part of that, I think, comes from this long, again, history of religion and in this case, Christianity's tension between condemning money condemning wealth and money on one hand, and then using wealth and money on other hands to describe itself. So just a case in point, a really sort of concrete example, you know, we can find sayings of Jesus that'll say things like, give away your money. It's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than a rich person to get into heaven. This language is very strong. That's warnings against wealth, warnings against money. And then Jesus will also say, you know, do these things like give away your wealth and you will have treasure in heaven, right? So you're still using language about wealth and money to motivate people. And to say, if you want a reward, you'll get a reward, but it'll be at a later point. So it's as opposed to totally throwing it out the window, what Jesus does is change that time frame and say, okay, you want wealth and money? Let's talk about it in this eternal time frame. And that's just one example of the ways that it's not so black and white. It's not so cut and dried because, you know, why still use that language and those ideas if they're so problematic? And that's just one example. If you look through the teachings and gospels Jesus uses so much economic and monetary language. And we find this in the early leaders of the church as well.
The question that comes to mind when you talk about how much Jesus in the gospel talks about currency and money and uses the idea of money is that really, he always spoke in parables and metaphors, and he always talked and used language that they could understand in that time from an earthly perspective. But is the idea that you're sort of positing that the use of the language is to talk about an idea of wealth, not in terms of earthly possession or in terms of capturing a bunch of stuff, but that the richness, that the wealth, the power of currency is the currency of the soul for eons past just this particular moment that we live in today?
It's a really great and insightful question, Patrick. Partly, yes. So partly what I'm saying is, at least in that example and some other examples, we can see Jesus and sometimes in the letters of Paul and others transpose this language of earthly riches and wealth to something like spiritual riches and wealth. And in that case, yes, there's a metaphor that's happening there. So part of what I'm interested in is, what are the consequences of doing that? Can we really then be free of this monetary economic ideas, or do we still need those to make sense of these metaphors? And then the other issue is, even if they meant it in the purest spiritual way, there's a whole history of implications of how this has been taken, applied, lived out that seem to be very earthly, very political, very economic. Various Christian emperors very soon sort of modeled themselves and their kingdoms over what they thought God was doing with these spiritual riches and treasures. But then they would do it, of course, with earthly riches and treasures. So there's a whole tradition of politics, like the divine right of kings and earthly emperors, that created economic models that were trying to model themselves after what they thought the divine economy was like. So it has material implications. And then even today, I mean, the language that people often throw around about so-and-so worshiping money or pursuing money in an idolatrous way, they're using and invoking this language. And we can also talk about the prosperity gospel and prosperity teaching as one example of this too within Christianity today, where some Christian teachers and pastors have literalized this message again to say, no, what God means is God does desire you to be actually wealthy. God does desire you to have actual riches. Again, we can find Christians across the centuries applying this in very material economic ways, which we need to at least reckon with that, regardless of whether we think they've gotten it wrong or not. There's still this whole history of 2,000 years of using these ideas in ways that have shaped our economics. We can look at the rise of capitalism as another thing that I teach about as being shaped very much by theological debates and ideas about God and the world. And these early economic thinkers that were providing these early theories of capitalism and the market were drawing on theology in many ways. So it has longstanding implications.
It seems to stand that if you're talking about the origin of government and society, that most of the text at that point was religious text. So it makes sense that a lot of those sort of principles that we espouse today as it relates to government, politics, society, morals, would be based upon a biblical or at least a religious text, which is very interesting. If you talk about the division between church and state, if the church is the foundation of the state, can there really be a separation between those things? You brought up prosperity gospel, which is always interesting to me because I think, you know, I grew up in a church, going to church every Sunday and Wednesday and Sunday night. And there was a strong relationship between how wealthy someone was with how blessed they were, mm-hmm. how in favor they were in God's eyes. And I think there's just a fundamental problem with that, because that doesn't take into account the zip code where you were born into. It doesn't take into account your race. It doesn't take into account your gender. It sort of places your favor with God on this very arbitrary and sometimes capricious thing, which is your ability to generate wealth. And I wonder, you know, I look at different movements that have happened within the church, you know, and you write that the idea of fundamentalism is really only an 18th, 19th, 20th century thought process, that the early founders of the church had a much more complicated understanding and relationship of what it meant to be a Christian than we talk about today. So I wonder if you could talk about that as well, this idea of where these thoughts and these beliefs come from, and if they really are the true essence of what Christianity is about.
Yeah, the question of fundamentalism is an interesting one, and it's a hotly debated topic. You know, it's been said that fundamentalism is a very modern phenomenon, and that might strike some people as odd because fundamentalism seems like it's regressive. It's trying to get back to something early and pre-modern, and that's often how it presents itself. We're getting back to the fundamentals, the basics, what the early first people believed. But fundamentalism, on one hand, is itself a reaction to modernity and modernization. A lot of early fundamentalist movements, at least in the U.S. and the Christian realm, were reacting to science, to new teachings about evolution, to new ideas about the world that they found to be troublesome and problematic. And so it was a response to the rise of modern science and modern worldviews. So in some sense, fundamentalism couldn't have existed without this first sort of movement of modernity. But fundamentalism is also really often, it's often reductive. It reduces ideas of the faith to a few bullet points. We have our sort of 10 doctrinal points, our 10 issues of our statement of faith. These are the fundamentals, the things you have to believe. And that way of thinking, this sort of bullet point list of propositions or, you know, quote unquote, religious facts is also a very modern way of thinking. I mean, again, we can think about the medieval and the ancient world as being much more comfortable with nuance, with the mystical, with language that's more figurative, etc. And so this desire to sort of get things down in black and white in this rigid sort of doctrine way is also a very modern way of thinking. And so ironically, fundamentalists are very modern, even though they see themselves as reacting to modernity.
Do we seek that type of fundamentalism today because we just, as a world, we're not well-read. We don't have critical thinking. So we just say, you know, don't eat shellfish. So we're not going to eat shellfish. Or we say women shouldn't speak in church. And we go, okay, women can't be ministers or pastors. So we just sort of take it at the surface level. But because we are now programmed not to be critically thinking, we just go, okay. And then we build policy, we build belief systems around very unexamined ideas that lack any kind of true rigor or any true kind of intellectual understanding of what the text really means. Is that where that leads? Is that the result? Is fundamentalism the result of that?
I think that's part of it. I mean, part of it is the response to, again, modernity being the sense that everything is in flux, right? I mean, the rise of the modern world is the increase in things like technology, industrialization, new ideas, globalization. Everything seems much more fast-paced, like we're standing on sand. You know, where's the rock that we can stand on? The sense of unease about how things are shifting and changing. And so partly this impulse in fundamentalism is this search for security. Give me the basic bare bones things that I can be sure about, because the world and life is changing and it's scary. Then the next move, as you say, is simplification. It's we don't have time to wade through all this information, this material. And also maybe we have suspicions about education because of how it might corrupt our spiritual beliefs. So let's keep it simple. And so let's just boil it down to these basic things. So, and then also just efficiency, right? So I think there's a lot of forces, but they do result in this typically, a streamlined way of approaching religion and faith that's often problematic, right? It siphons out too much, and then it becomes too rigid and dogmatic with what remains, and kind of ignores or wants to resist the nuance and the back and forth that's a part of these communities. One of the ways that religion and theology has been described over the centuries is it's actually communities of debate. It's about ongoing debate and discussion. What do we really believe? And what is this about? And there's this sense of always a back and forth and a dialogue that's happening, wrestling together, as opposed to the sense of just confident assurance all the time, you know, full stop, no debate sort of attitude that often shows up in fundamentalist communities. And so really for the majority of the church's life, it's been this sense of, again, we need to have ongoing debate and discussion about this.
I was reading your book last night, Divine Currency. And in that, you talk about God as an economic administrator. And you say Christ is the currency. Can you explain those analogies? And is that not just a touch heretical?
I love that you're bringing up heresy. This is good. We need to go there.
Let's do it, man. Yeah. I'm totally ready for it. I was so intrigued by that. Because again, it kind of runs counter to sort of what is in the zeitgeist about this idea of, well, in certain zeitgeist, I guess you could say, about the idea of God being love and Christ being love. And I leave you one last commandment that you love one another as I have loved you. And you come in and you say, no, God is the economic administrator and Christ is currency, which if you plan out to the next sort of the next idea of Christ is currency, are you asserting that the crucifixion was the ultimate sacrifice, not from a spiritual perspective, but from a perspective of economy and commerce?
Yeah, I love this. So it's fun because when I have a conversation with the proverbial person on the plane next to me when I'm going somewhere and they ask me what I do and what I work on and I talk about this work, I get two often very different responses. One will be kind of what you just articulated, like sort of shock. Like you can't associate Christ with money. That seems blasphemous. That seems heretical in some way. So there's this anxiety about that close connection. The other response will be something like, oh yeah, religion's all about the money, isn't it? Like I know I've heard about all those treasures hidden in the Vatican or whatever it may be, right? And so there's the other response of people's more cynical read of this. But what I'm trying to say is that these ideas of God as an administrator and Christ as currency are ideas that I find are present in these early theologians. So again, this is not me saying, here's this new theology that we should all believe. I'm trying to recall ideas that are there in these early Christian texts. And just to be clear for folks listening, this book, Divine Currency, looks at Christian theology mostly in the 300s to the 500s. So a long time ago, but really in this period where formal Christian theology and doctrine is being hammered out, it's being given the stamp of being official because of all these various councils and meetings that are happening across the Mediterranean when the church is defining itself. So that these Christian theologians are reading the Bible and reading other teachings, and they say, okay, we have to define what we believe. So I look at this period because I think it's significant for the rest of Christian history. And what we find is some thinkers are using language, literally, of God as a steward or an administrator or a manager. And we have plenty of language of Christ as the payment, as the compensation for sin, for humanity's debt, etc. So that language is all there. The question is, what do we make of it? What do we do with it? What I'm saying is this language matters. We can't just say, oh, redemption, that means something spiritual. Yes, it might mean something spiritual, but it has this whole economic background to it. Redemption literally means to be bought back. And it was used in contexts, particularly of slavery and debt slavery, where if somebody was redeemed, it was because you were a debt slave to somebody else, and somebody came and redeemed you, paid for you to set you free, bought you back from slavery. And so that becomes the central metaphor for Christianity to explain, well, what happens during salvation? What is salvation? What does this even mean? And these early thinkers said, okay, we are in debt slavery to the devil, and we are bound to him as his slave. We need somebody to redeem us, to buy us back. And so Christ is the payment, is the currency to do this. So that whole economic logic is there, and it speaks to your language or your question about this idea of the cross. It's both. There's language of sacrifice, and there's language of economy and commerce that are both used in these texts and in these early thinkers. The language of divine economy is frequently invoked and spoken of.
You also did something. I was like, this guy is going to like get us. I'm living in Boston now, so I'm like, I'm not too far from Salem. The stakes might still be there. Should I be reading this book? Because you also say in the book, you also infer, you draw this other line, this comparison between the incarnate God or the word made flesh and the act of imperialism seen in the world. So you're essentially saying that the idea of an incarnate God as a God of salvation is also a God of stewardship, oversight, and material resources. And I was like, wow.
There are some links there. So this language, again, of God, there's language of God as this cosmic manager, almost a cosmic money manager, managing the resources of the cosmos, of the world, all the goods of creation. And Christ then becomes this, on one hand, he's described as a steward of God the Father, managing this economy on earth. But he's also sometimes described as the actual payment, the actual currency that is offered to keep this economy going. And so that language is there to describe what God is doing in the world, what salvation is about, what the kingdom of God is. And so when somebody like the Emperor Constantine, who is the first Christian emperor, wants to sort of create his kingdom and say that he's doing things in a Christian way, this language can then be kind of a template, can kind of be a model for what it means to rule as a Christian emperor. Well, I'm going to steward my kingdom the way that God and Christ steward theirs. And so resources, money, people, subjects all become managed in a certain way. But there's an important point too, that many of these Christian thinkers will describe God using Christ and this payment as a way to conquer Satan, to conquer the enemy, to conquer spiritual forces that are against God and claim this territory for God. So what happens when that gets modeled after by a Christian emperor or somebody on earth? They're going to go out and conquer new lands, claim the heathen, the non-believers for God using military and economic means. And so we see this pattern over and over again of claiming things in the name of God. So imperialism, colonialism, I think there are some ways that this can be traced to these kinds of theological ideas.
That was my question. You know, yeah. are we creating the idea of a Machiavellian, a cunning church, a cunning God to do whatever they need to do to amass power, control, influence?
I think it's there. I mean, I think, again, the history is there. We see the examples of leaders doing this. So whether we want to, again, we can debate and say, well, this is not what the original theology was about. They've misunderstood it. I mean, that's a fair debate. But the point is, plenty of leaders and plenty of teachers have used this theology to enable this kind of Machiavellian or imperialist approach. So my work, again, is just trying to expose this. Hey, this is there. And so it's there in the tradition. What are we going to do about it? What are we going to do about its effects in the modern world today? We need to reckon with that history and not deny it and not say, oh, those people just weren't being good Christians. Well, maybe, but they have a basis in the tradition to do these problematic things, because these texts can be interpreted sometimes in these ways. And if God is doing things economically, then that seems to give license to those who are trying to emulate God to do things in a certain economic way as well.
In your mind, what is the relationship? Where is the line between history and religion and economics and politics? Because I think you kind of thrown them into this bag now, and you've kind of shaken it up, and you've said, okay, if we're going to look at religion and God, you have to look at the idea of currency because the language demands that we do. And then we have to look at the political systems that we exist in, because if it's based on texts that the Greeks and Romans were looking at, those texts were religious based. I mean, there was poets and things like that and plays,
but
a lot of that is the idea of system and governance.
Yeah.
Is based upon religious texts to a certain degree. So where are the lines of all of that? And how much should we be looking at the Bible in terms of direct relationship to how we choose to operate and believe in history and our governments? And how much should it be viewed as gospel is not history, it's gospel, and it serves a different purpose? We're not trying to go back and find the exact date of the flood, or are we?
Some people are, yeah.
And is that necessary?
I know there's a lot of great questions there. So one of the lines I want to pick up on is this issue of, and you mentioned this before, like today we seem to have the separation of church and state, right? So what do we make of all this? So part of what you're speaking to is this notion of secularization, that we've tried to move and to differentiate between something called religion, something called politics, something called economics, whereas in the ancient world, these were more blurred together. The lines weren't so clear, although they had ideas that these were kind of distinct things. But to be a good politician meant to honor the Roman gods, right? I mean, it was all blurred together. In general, I'm a fan of the separation of church and state. I think it was a good creation. It's also very young historically. It's a couple hundred years old, really. 300, 400, depending on where we want to sort of think about these efforts to split things. So part of what I'm trying to do is to say, hey, if we're sort of curious today, why are we still having these struggles? Thinking about contemporary American politics, like religion rears its head all the time still. And it doesn't seem like we operate in a fully secular sort of political sphere. Religion is totally relevant in so many ways. And so I'm trying to give us resources to understand why this is still the case. And then resources we can draw on if we want to create new proposals, policies, projects that we might want to offer into the world to change things for better, to create more just societies, to create societies where human life can flourish, et cetera. So we can't pretend like this history wasn't there or that it doesn't still have so many downstream effects. So I think that's part of what I'm trying to say is that we're still wrestling with these downstream effects of this time when these were all merged together. And maybe we're slowly trying to tease them apart. And I think we can also debate whether that's ever fully possible. You know, we're wrestling with these links today even. And so it's very common to think about the religion and politics connection. And I'm trying to bring in economics into that as well and make it a triad. And I'm sure there are others that we could bring in there as well. That are all relevant to make sense of the world that we live in, the institutions that seem to shape us, and to think about how we can try to shape them in better ways.
Is there a difference in your mind between religion and spirituality? When you say religion, to me, it implies a system, and a system therefore must have rules. There are economies. When I think about spirituality, I think about the things of the heart. I think about things that we may not be able to give language to that express what it means to be fully human in search of the divine and in search of meaning. So is there a difference?
It's a good and tough question and a dangerous question to ask to a religion professor, because I could do a whole semester on just this issue, right? Like we wrestle with this all the time as religion scholars. How do we define religion? Is it different than spirituality? So it's great. I think I like that distinction you made. I think, you know, as a sort of general fast and loose dichotomy, I think that's fine to think about religion as these institutions, these systems, these traditions. Certainly it's how it's used today. And then to people who define themselves as spiritual but not religious, right, is this very common category these days, are intentionally trying to make this distinction and say, I don't participate in these organized rituals and traditions, but I do have a sense of whether it's God, a higher power, the cosmos, the universe. Something more than that they want to honor and nurture. And I think that's I'm totally fine with that. I think that's a useful distinction. And again, I could be nitpicky and we could have this class and really unpack really where are the lines that blur. And I think they blur in a lot of ways. And some things that people think of as religion might be more spirituality. Some things people think of as spirituality might be more religion. But I think it's a distinction that is totally, totally legitimate and one that has a lot of traction today.
You have made a career, a life of studying religion, God. Do you believe in God?
Sure.
Why not?
Why not? Again, like to ask a religion professor who spent their career kind of deconstructing and critiquing this, it's a hard question to answer. I think began my journey of studying religion as an undergraduate, partly because these were ideas and concerns that were very meaningful to me. You know, I was wrestling with, do I believe in God? What do I think about the big questions of meaning and significance in life? That's why I ended up studying religion. And through the process of studying religion, you know, it challenges many of the beliefs that you have, right? The things you accept as sort of obvious truths, it can erode those and deconstruct those. But I also don't find dogmatic atheism appealing either, to kind of go to the other extreme and say, well, there is no God and I'm going to sort of take this hard stance. That's also in many ways problematic. And again, we could have a long conversation about how atheism is kind of like dogmatic atheism is a kind of fundamentalism, a version of it. But yeah, so I'm happy to say, sure. Like, I think I want to believe. And I think, you know, I often say, I don't know what it means to believe, but I think I know what it means to hope. And so I hope that some of this stuff is real, whether or not I know what it means to believe it anymore. But I hope a lot of this is real, because a lot of it is very comforting, inspiring, motivational, et cetera. And I think there's a lot of good that can come from this. I mean, I'm the first to talk about a lot that's toxic and destructive about religion. And I've experienced that, but I've also experienced communities and spaces of love, healing, forgiveness, that are also tremendously powerful. So I think it continues to offer things that are worthwhile, that shouldn't be rejected. But it needs, we need a critical lens. You know, I want, particularly if folks that are listening here that identify as religious believers, like, I think a critical lens that's able to be humble and acknowledge the problems, shortcomings, abuses of these beliefs and systems, and to be out in the world in ways that are not judgmental, not condemning, not antagonistic, but are, you know, again, presences of humility, love, compassion. I think that's awesome, right? That's great. And we need more of that, particularly in this day and age. And I think even thinking about our contemporary context in the States, there's a lot of ugly religion in the public sphere, I have to say. And I think we need different ways to go about it.
Who do you believe God to be?
I still am attracted to this notion of something larger, something higher, something that in moments of fear, crisis, I can sort of fall back on. I'm happy to say that that's even like a crutch, if you will. Often people will use that as a critique, and I'm happy to say, well, you know, maybe, but it's maybe a good crutch. You know, I like to think there's more to this life and this world. And, you know, I think that's part of what makes humans such unique animals, is that we're afflicted with this idea that there is something larger than what we experience and see in this world. So we are creatures of the imagination. We are creatures of art and creativity. We are creatures of imagining alternative possibilities, right? And this is beautiful thing about humans, as well as this bane of our existence, because we are continually discontent, continually yearning for more. And there's something about that that religion speaks to, and it helps us explain some of the origins of religion, certainly, right? Is that we have these kind of cravings and desires. And so I think, you know, an idea of God as something that helps provide that comfort. But I also, you know, I joke that if I pray today, most of my prayers are just curse words under my breath, cussing about, you know, life and how crappy it can be, right? That those are, if I'm praying, it's something like that. So I don't have this real strong piety or sense of kind of devout, super spiritual relationship with God. But I like to think that there's something listening when I'm kind of shouting out something into the universe, either in desperation or in celebration.
We kind of just come full circle if you talk about the human being needing to have something bigger than us, a bigger meaning beyond what we're here, something larger to look at. It kind of sort of, in a way, draws an arrow, a line back to this idea of melancholy, mourning, yearning for something that is without us, not necessarily within us. I have a last question for you. So this season, we're talking to people about who have found and are using their voices to make change in the world. Have you found yours? And if you have, what are you saying with it?
I'm still on that journey. I've certainly been finding my voice. And part of it, I think, is, you know, thinking about the themes we've talked about today. I think, you know, I want to help foster more reflective, compassionate people in the world. And I think that's what, you know, what my work tries to be about, is reflection, deep thought, critical thinking, as well as compassion, solidarity, empathy. Those are these two things that really preoccupy me, which is why I do my coaching, my leadership development, is to find those like-minded people, as well as my scholarship, my insights on religion as well. And so I think those having more of that in the world can help, you know, again, construct a more, hopefully more just, more compassionate, more life-giving space in society. So I'm trying to articulate my voice in ways to foster more of that.
Devin, thank you so much for your time today and for answering some of my questions about your work.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate the conversation. Thank you for the deep and profound questions. I feel like we covered a lot.
Yeah, we'll have to do another one of these and go just deeper into one of those subjects to be a whole.
Sure, absolutely.
Thank you so much, Devin. And to those of you who are watching or listening, remember, we all have a voice, so use yours wisely. Bye, everyone.